Monday, October 31st, Halloween, began in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, at the very early hour of about 5:30. Sleeping and eating get short shrift on this trip. First coffee and then the hairdresser, and then a last look at the arts and crafts of Malaysia that had been gathered together in a sort of sun porch room for us to make purchases from. And about 6:40, with Ambassador and Mrs. Bell, we left for the palace on top of the hill. The band was playing the Star Spangled Banner on fifes. The Grand Chamberlain greeted us, and we walked under the gold ceremonial umbrellas up to the porch where the King and Queen awaited us. Inside, in the reception room, delicious-looking little morsels were passed on beautiful trays. I took some, but never really got to eat them. That, too, is typical of this trip. And then we said our goodbye to the King and Queen and to this beautiful, rich, green country. There were people all along the streets to the airport, though not thick at this early hour. We walked down the red carpet, shaking hands with the American sector, the diplomatic corps, the government officials, one little group of American children in Halloween masks, which carried me back 15 years and thousands of miles. And at 7:40, we were wheels up for Korea, facing a six-hour flight, during which I slept, ate an ample lunch, and read about Korea. One gets to regarding these long flights as an oasis, a haven, a much-desired period of insulation in this 17-day crescendo of activity. Somewhere between Kuala Lumpur and Korea, we passed over Vietnam, right over Saigon. There were fighter planes accompanying us, then our own. I was asleep. I did not see them. But as we approached the special city of Seoul, I saw off our wing three little rock fighter planes flying in perfect formation, and off the other wing, three more. A thrilling entry. And if I thought I had seen everything in welcome, I was indeed completely wrong. Nothing was ever like Korea in all the visits in all my life. We arrived at Gimpo International Airport about 3 o'clock local time. Ambassador and Mrs. Brown came aboard the plane, and for the second time on this trip, I felt that I was in the hands of very special friends. First the Clarks in Australia, and now Mrs. Winfield Brown, who had been Peggy Bell, in whose home I had visited at the university back in the 1930s, where I'd known her mother and Sister Kitty and Brother Francis Kelly well. They're one of the most extraordinarily able ambassadorial couples I've ever met, and I don't know a job where a man needs a working wife more. They escorted us down the steps of the plane, and here the pageantry began, for the railings were festooned with flowers, a mass of flowers from top to bottom, and we were facing a sea of men and women and children, the first emplacement of the 2 million Koreans that welcomed us. There were President and Mrs. Park at the foot of the steps. I've been hearing ever since the beginning of the Manila conference that Mrs. Park did not accompany the president because she was making preparations for our visit, but I had no idea of the scope of the preparations. I was to see them in the next 2.5 days, ranging from new china and silver chopsticks, the state dinner, the first such service they'd ever had, I'm told, to the familiar music that was played for us along the streets, to the mammoth Korean and American flags that floated in the air, anchored by balloons, above the civic square. Suddenly, a squad of ROK Air Force jet fighters zoomed out of nowhere and flew low overhead, leaving a pathway of red, green, blue, yellow, and pink smoke. And the bands played our two national anthems, and we stood very erect, and the cannon boomed out the 21-gun salute. And anybody whose pulse didn't race was a child of dullness indeed. I looked up at the rainbow colors in the sky and thought of the two other rainbows we had seen on this trip, Australia and the Philippines, and I took it as a good omen. Lyndon and President Park reviewed the troops standing in a jeep. Somehow, this seems like the Koreans' no-nonsense. It was thoroughly done, quickly over. President Park is a slight, dark, tough-looking man. I believe him a good friend and a formidable enemy, who looks like smiling doesn't come easy to him. Nevertheless, he was smiling most of the time during this afternoon. He completely lacks the hero image, the glamour, the physical charm of Marcos. And yet there is something commanding about him, something very firm, and I would lay my bet on him. Mrs. Park is smiling all the time, a very womanly, gracious, gentle, thoroughly high-class person. She's among the favorite first ladies who've ever come to visit us in Washington with me. I was soon loaded with flowers, always presented by children. During the speeches, I raised my eyes to see what the terrain looked like. There in front of us were the austere, forbidding mountains rising dark against the skyline. In the years of 50-53, when Korea was a painful word to Americans, loomed darkly in my mind. It was a time of stress and uncertainty and wrenching national decisions. And more than 50,000 Americans died somewhere in those same mountains. And now this country, Korea, is one of the success stories of Asia. I hope I shall live to see the same thing happen with the beast that we wrestle with today. Perhaps it is this bond of association that made Korea for me the most dramatic stop of all. Although from the very beginning, it seemed a stark, almost drab country with little grass and few trees to relieve the grim mountains and the gray city, more than 50% of which had been destroyed by the invasion in 50-53. But my feeling that these were tough, determined, industrious, intelligent people going places grew with every hour that I was there. I liked them. It was past 3:40 when we got into limousines and, led by our motorcycle escort of 31, began the 10-mile or so drive to the heart of the city. It was a tremendous, emotion-packed 2 hours. Things I will never forget. A sea of faces on all sides. And whenever we came to an open square, the tributary streets into it were full of people as far as your eye could see, and all the windows above you. The amazing variety of signs, homemade, many of them with pictures of Lyndon, some sentimental, welcome King of Kings, the greatest leader of the world. With a friendly hand clasp, we welcome you. We like LBJ with all our hearts. Many right out of a Western movie, picturing Lyndon in cowboy boots and a big hat and two guns, saying, "Welcome, Texas Giant. Gallop, cowboy. Thanks, Texas boy, we love you." And one hilarious one, "Texas Bull, we like." And even one that said, "Welcome, Bluebird." And there were big posters of Lyndon in President Park. This is a man's country. I don't remember of any of me and Mrs. Park. School children lined up in their uniforms, black and maroon and blue. Many with the girls wearing trousers, Mrs. Park explained they did in winter. We passed innumerable bands, a group doing a harvest dance with dragon and mask and a king and a crown. Once on the edge of town, Lyndon made his way through the crowd to a rice paddy, and I saw him balancing atop a narrow dike while he reached over to greet workers in the field. 8 times he stopped to shake hands, standing in the door of the car, waving and talking. Once he sat on the roof, waving Korean and American flags, while the crowd around him went wild. I soon saw that I was no match for this crowd. To get into it was to be swallowed up, devoured. So I stayed inside that bubble-top car with Mrs. Park and the interpreter, stepping out only to receive flowers and bend over and greet children and wave and smile and nearly get run over as they made a dash for Lyndon. And then back into the car where the stack of flowers grew higher and higher on the shelf behind Mrs. Park and me. We passed a huge monumental arch, which Mrs. Park called the South Gate, and on every inch of it, on what appeared to be steps, were standing girls in colorful native costumes. Emotions grew higher, the roar of the crowd louder. There was no end to the signs. Lyndon in a Mandarin hat, leader of the world, arch enemy of communism, our bosom friend, Ladybird, fly high up. You outpolled all your opponents in our Gallup poll. Please come, President Johnson, apostle of peace, welcome. And one whose philosophy was a bit mixed up. Welcome to the king of democracy. Another delicious one. We love brave Johnny. There was not one single demonstrator or hostile sign. Between the South Gate and the City Hall Plaza, we showered with confetti and flowers. The air above was thick with them, the windshield covered. And then at the plaza, when we thought emotions had reached their peak and there could be no more, we heard the roar of the massed crowd, estimated at 350,000, and a chorus of 2,000 girls in bright traditional dress sang the Arirang song for us. and high in the air above floated two giant flags, the Korean and the American, which were anchored by balloons. Here the mayor was to receive us and give us the golden key to the city. We climbed the steps to the reception platform between two columns of girls in pink satin scattering rose petals, and then at the top I turned to face the mass of 350,000 people. It was an awe-inspiring sight. They swayed like wheat in the wind. Some were pushing to get closer, and those in front couldn't move. And I could see that some, the girls in the singing chorus, were being trampled. The crowd was on a razor edge between ecstasy and frenzy. It was frightening. Here and there, I saw police move in with their sticks, making people sit down, carrying out girls on their shoulders. President Park was speaking impassively. I could not see that he noticed. He said the Korean people were welcoming the American president as our closest friend, our most honored guest, the foremost political leader of the free world of this century. We have been much indebted to you as comrades in arms. And looking at him and at these people, you believed him when he said, "Please be assured that ours is not a nation which will indefinitely continue to be indebted to others, but rather is a nation which knows how to requite its obligations, which has a keen sense of responsibility, and which abides by good faith." Mayor Kim presented the real gold key to the city of Seoul, to Lyndon. His nickname, delightfully, is Bulldozer, because he gets things done in a tough, fast fashion. While we were seated, waiting Lyndon's turn to speak, he leaned over at me and said, "You've got confetti in your hair. Take your comb and get it out." I shook my head, not wanting to comb my hair in front of thousands of people. And to my embarrassment, he took out his comb, leaned over, and flicked it out.
I was annoyed.
Piece by piece, I was annoyed. Well, so much for my sense of good public relations. It was the thing that caught the eye of the Korean press, all the women especially, and was repeated to us over and over. Apparently, to them, it meant that he was solicitous of me, careful with me, and they liked it. In his speech, Lyndon said, "To an American, the free soil of Korea is hallowed ground." He spoke of the 54,000 Americans who died in the bitter 50-53 battle, of our two partnerships against red aggression, that one and the present one, in which the South Koreans have 45,000 soldiers besides ours, in Vietnam, and of Korea's remarkable economic progress. And then it was over, and we made our way from the crowded square and left by chopper for Walker Hill, feeling absolutely exhausted by the emotional pitch of the last 2 hours. Walker Hill is a resort clinging to the high hills overlooking the special city of Seoul, named after an American general who died in the fighting of the 50s. We were to stay in Villa Emerald. The Browns took us there, and it was a charming place, furnished with antique Korean chests, some lovely Celadon porcelains, some of their national treasures, I understand, and a beautiful screen with alternate panels of butterflies and fans. Its large picture windows look down upon Seoul and off to the mountains. By now we had made complete circle, leaving Washington in the fall, going to the spring of forsythia and tulips in Australia, and here in Korea, back to the golden ginkgo trees and bright red maples, the last of them, that we had left in October, Washington. I had time for a little talk with Peggy, and then the much-needed ministrations of the hairdresser, and into my green Princess Margaret evening dress, over which I wore the long cloak of Korean fabric that Mrs. Kim had given me for the state dinner given by President and Mrs. Park. A little past 8, we left in the helicopter with the Browns for a blue house, the Koreans' White House, our presidential residence. There, on the front steps, we were greeted by President and Mrs. Park, and I would swear the band was playing Dixie. In fact, in all of this roaring, tumultuous, wonderful day, we were curiously accompanied by well-known old-time American songs. It was just as though somebody had gone through Seoul with sheet music, 50 favorite songs of America. I'd heard "O Susanna," "Way Down Upon the Suwannee River," "My Old Kentucky Home," and over and over and over, "Texas Fight," "Yellow Rose of Texas," and "The Eyes of Texas." One more example of the infinitely studious and industrious way they had gone about making us feel at home. Later, I was told that Blue House had been painted just 3 days before our arrival. Also, the Capitol had been, as well as the Korea House and the Art Gallery. Blue House was spacious and handsome, but there was something austere and spare about it, a characteristic I sensed in everything about Korea, its buildings, its people. There was a receiving line in the grand reception room, and we met the guests, some 200 of them. And then we went into a private room where the exchange of gifts took place. Somewhere, I don't quite remember, except that it was a quiet moment. We met one of the park's daughters, a shy, sweet girl, and this lent the visit another touch of the sincerity that so marked it, to share their home life with us. Mrs. Park gave me two lovely brocades, one yellow, she explained that she had selected it because she knew it was my favorite color, and one embroidered with lilies of the valley. She told me smilingly this was the flower of happiness. I never ceased to be amazed at both her thoughtfulness and her diligence, all the infinite details that have gone into planning this visit. From personally supervising our apartment at Emerald Villa, the Browns told us that both she and the President came out and walked through room by room, changing, asking for additions, to ordering the 2.5 tons of confetti fluttered through the air above us at City Hall Plaza, and the millions of chrysanthemums festooned our way everywhere, for choosing every one of the dances and auditioning them for the 30 minutes entertainment after dinner. From Blue House, we went directly to the Capitol building, where we were greeted by Prime Minister and Mrs. Chung, and then up the curving red-carpeted staircase, I held on to President Park's arm, for a staircase in long evening dress and high-heeled shoes is always a mental hazard to me. Into the main hall for the state dinner. The President murmured to me that they'd had to divide the dinner into two rooms, but they were connected by sound. The same problem we have in the White House. But the four of us were seated side by side at the head of a long horseshoe table. Whoa. I was a sponge soaking up every detail, the walls festooned with flowers, a lovely miniature screen at each place, a menu card made in authentic fashion, folding panels of wood and silk, the peacock crest embroidered at the top, and the menu done alternately in Korean, whose characters I cannot distinguish from any other Eastern language. They all look like chicken scratching to me. And in English, first gingi, steamed rice, in a bowl. Everything was in a bowl. Delicate blue and white china bowls and small dishes. Nothing that I would call a plate. And glassware, all with a peacock crest, and silver chopsticks. I understand that everything was bought new and especially for the visit. There was abalone soup, an ambrosia casserole, and mustard-spiced vegetable, such strange unknowns as fried sea greens and toasted cilibar. And I was relieved to see familiar names as sliced cold beef and charcoal broil beef. But amazingly, they came in portions the size of your little finger. Everything did. Lots of dishes and very small servings. The kujul pan, or 9 delicacies, were mostly unknown to me. Some tasted like shredded pickled vegetables. Since I like the people so much, I suppose I can dare to say that I like the food least of all. And it was only when we reached the desserts, honeyed pine nut nougat, and that simple old familiar fruit, apple, that I really enjoyed it. The rice wine, about a thimbleful, was strong and stinging, but it was not refilled. In fact, I had the feeling that the Koreans do not eat heavily or drink heavily. Ended with ginseng nectar tea. And then there were toasts with champagne. And a custom of this part of the world is that the national anthem strikes up, the guests rise, glass in hand, and stand until the anthem is finished. Then the president makes a toast, and then you drink. One sits down, and in a few minutes the process is repeated. The other national anthem, with guests standing at attention, glass in hand. The toast, the lifting of the glass, quite a lengthy process. But the evening was not yet over. We drove next to Citizens Hall, 4 of us together in a limousine, and all the other guests in a bus. What a night for logistics. Hours moved smoothly. At Citizens Hall, we were escorted to a box, the 4 of us, to watch a 30-minute entertainment of Korean folk dancing, which began, sedately enough, with the typical court dances, beautiful girls dancing gracefully with flower crowns on their heads. The costumes, the colors, and the musical instruments had been the same for hundreds of years. This one came from the Three Kingdoms period of about 600 A.D. The tempo changed to the Bangatariyong, which is a miller's song, and then to the 12 drum dance, which is a form of Buddhist monk dance, and the dancer races around the stage to beat on the separate 12 drums, hurrying madly from drum to drum, striking each with all his might. I leaned over to the president and says, "That reminds me of Lyndon trying to get all of his work done." It was a veritable crescendo of activity, but we hadn't seen anything yet. The evening closed with the farmer's dance, the traditional festival music for the farmers in Korea, celebrating a rich harvest. Dressed in bright costumes, the farmers whirled onto the stage, each with long streamers of ribbon attached to his hat, which, as he danced, floated, looped, circled around him in a madly increasing tempo. The dancer would use his neck with all the agility you would use your arm, to the left, to the right, whirling it like a wheel. It was a tour de force of skill and sheer physical strength. The dignified audience loved it. As a star took the center of the stage, bounding, somersaulting, twirling ever faster and faster, his neck miraculously keeping the ribbons spinning around him. They clapped, they cheered. It was like watching a football game. And finally, the dancer dropped from exhaustion, and the next one took over. Wonderful finale for the evening. Miraculously, it ended on time. We gratefully said goodbye because it had been a very full and wearing and glorious day. By midnight, we had helicoptered to Walker Hill, and we were in the comfortable Villa Emerald to spend our first night in the special city of Seoul, which had greeted us with the biggest crowd ever to turn out in Korean history, 2 million people being twice as many as the crowd that welcomed President Eisenhower in 1953.